Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Eric LeCompte of School of the Americas Watch, who looks into the connections between the alleged abuse of Iraqi detainees in U.S.-run prisons and the Pentagon training of Latin American soldiers in torture techniques. Journalist Michael Scherer, who discusses his investigation into the government's questionable system of hiring private contractors to work for the Pentagon and dozens of other federal agencies. And economist Max Sawicki, who examines the impact of the Bush administration's large military expenditures and tax cuts, which have led to record deficit spending. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
A decade after the genocide in Rwanda, crimes against humanity are once again taking place in Africa, this time in Darfur, the western edge of Sudan, where more than 1 million people have been displaced. In April, a United Nations team investigating human rights abuses along the Sudan-Chad border painted a dire picture of the Darfur crisis. Yet the report was effectively ignored at the annual meeting of the UN Human Rights Commission in Geneva. According to the news magazine In These Times, the UN Commission was unable to do anything more than issue a tepid statement that failed to condemn Sudan for what the UN Undersecretary for Humanitarian Affairs called scorched tactics in Darfur. To put down the Darfur rebellion that started in 2003, the Sudanese government, run by the National Islamic Front, recruited Arabic militias called the Janjaweed to sweep in on horseback, burn villages, rape women, and destroy local food supplies and livestock. While it is difficult to gauge the damage, human rights monitors say over 50,000 people from Darfur have already been killed, and another 1.2 million people suffer from severe malnutrition. The May rains will make any transport of humanitarian aid more difficult and help spread cholera and other waterborne diseases. The Sudanese government has already twice denied UN humanitarian teams access to Darfur. The Khartoum government can keep out aid workers, say observers, so long as the UN Security Council refuses to deal with the Darfur crisis in a meaningful way. The Ontario, Canada College of Family Physicians has identified an alarming link between common household pesticides and brain cancer, prostate cancer, leukemia, and other acute diseases. The study also found a relationship between regular exposure to agricultural pesticides and harm to reproductive health. The harm, the health study concluded, could come from pesticide residue on food, ant spray, or a tick collar worn by a domesticated cat. Medical researchers have consistently found that children are more vulnerable to pesticide poisoning than adults because they are still growing and have less developed systems to excrete chemicals. According to the Toronto-based Globe and Mail newspaper, both industry and Canadian government agencies have disputed the study's conclusions that exposure to pesticides is a threat to human health. The doctor study comes at a time when many Canadian cities are debating measures to ban the use of pesticides in gardens and lawns. As Kathy Vakil, one of the study's authors, noted, there are available alternatives to most pesticides in common use. She argues people need to think long and hard if they want to take the risk for themselves and their children for the sake of a golf green lawn. Britain's independent newspaper reports the state of California is putting the brakes on the use of touchscreen voting in light of a massive failure of digital voting machines in March's presidential primary. During the March 12th primary, two counties suffered a breakdown of digital machines because the battery packs attached to them were weak. In San Diego, there were no backup paper ballots available, disenfranchising tens of thousands of voters. Further, several thousand votes for John Kerry were mistakenly assigned to Dick Gephardt, who dropped out after the Iowa caucuses. Kim Alexander of the California Voter Foundation complained that the new computerized voting system is not tested for software bugs, malicious codes, or for so-called backdoors, enabling hackers to tamper with touchscreen machines. With the general election only 6 months away, California election officials are not eager to take any chances with digital machines and suffer a possible Florida-style election scandal. The Special Election Commission voted to bar one machine, the TSX, made by Diebold Election Systems, because of what the state calls misleading promises made by Diebold. California Secretary of State Kevin Shelley is backing the new limits on digital voting. Shelley has already pushed for rules requiring voter-certified paper records of ballots cast on touchscreen voting machines. yet voting machine manufacturers and county registrars are likely to resist any limits on the use of electronic voting in the November election. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
While Congress viewed thousands of photographs of U.S. military personnel abusing and sexually humiliating Iraqi detainees in Baghdad's Abu Ghraib prison, the nation was horrified by the videotaped beheading of American businessman Nicholas Berg, confirming the fears of violent repercussions resulting from the torture allegations in Iraq and beyond. The masked insurgents in the videotape stated they had executed Berg in retaliation for the abuse of Iraqi prisoners. Thus far, the Pentagon has filed criminal charges against seven U.S. soldiers for their alleged mistreatment of Iraqi prisoners, with public court-martials getting underway in Iraq on May 19th. Although Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld denied in public testimony before Congress that the Pentagon had authorized the abusive interrogation techniques employed at Abu Ghraib prison, a recent article by investigative reporter Seymour Hersh in the New Yorker magazine claims that Secretary Rumsfeld had authorized a secret operation that encouraged physical coercion and sexual humiliation of Iraqi prisoners in an effort to generate more intelligence about the growing insurgency in Iraq. While the White House and Pentagon maintain that the abuse of prisoners in Iraq is an aberration, the history of the U.S. Army's training school for Latin American soldiers tells a different story. The School of the Americas at Fort Benning, Georgia, now known as the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation, has for over a decade trained thousands of soldiers and officers from nations across Latin America in torture techniques and psychological warfare. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Eric LeCompte, organizing coordinator with the group School of the Americas Watch, who looks into the connections between the alleged abuse of Iraqi detainees in U.S. custody and the Pentagon training of Latin American soldiers who have been complicit in widespread human rights abuses and atrocities.
The School of the Americas is a training base that's located at Fort Benning, Georgia. And this particular training base, over the last 50 years, has trained over 60,000 soldiers from Latin American countries, Colombia, Bolivia, El Salvador, Brazil, in such techniques as torture, execution, assassination, counterinsurgency, combat skills. And the soldiers from these countries who come to the United States to this U.S. taxpayer-funded school, they've learned these skills and they've gone back to their home countries and they've used these skills against their own people. And right now, what we're hearing about Abu Ghraib, what we're hearing about Iraq in terms of the alleged torture that's taken place against Iraqi prisoners there, we at the School of the Americas Watch see that as an actual matter of U.S. foreign policy, that unfortunately what's happened in Abu Ghraib is not an isolated incident. It's not an aberration of U.S. foreign policy. It's actually a clear illustration of U.S. foreign policy. And, Scott, we see that so clearly with what has happened at the School of the Americas in Fort Benning, Georgia. In 1996, the Pentagon was forced to release, through grassroots and congressional pressure, manuals that were used at this school. And these were training manuals that the Washington Post and the New York Times dubbed as torture manuals, because these manuals, which trained these Latin American soldiers, actually instructed them to use such tactics as torture and execution against church leaders, human rights advocates, and union organizers. In fact, these manuals, they were told, in terms of the torture techniques within them, these soldiers should use them on those who, open quotes, do union organizing or recruiting. They should be used on those, open quotes, who make accusations that the government has failed to meet the basic needs of the people. So when we look at what's happening in Abu Ghraib and other places of Iraq, for us, we see it as another incident of this U.S. foreign policy which does promote torture like it has been promoted at the School of the Americas at Fort Benning, Georgia.
It seems that the U.S. press and the Congress have very little memory of the revelations about these torture manuals related to U.S. policy in Central America, because they seem to be not mentioned at all in the context of many at the Pentagon and at the White House saying this is not something that America does, that America does not torture its prisoners, does not encourage the mistreatment or abuse of those in our nation's custody. But of course, we do have these torture manuals, which really speak to a wholly different reality.
Exactly. Unfortunately, I think the cliche line comes to mind: those who can't remember their history are doomed to repeat it. And that's exactly what we're seeing in terms of what happened at Abu Ghraib. These kinds of torture manuals coming back and these kinds of torture manuals being used. Unfortunately, it's clear that members of Congress, it's clear that members of the Pentagon don't want to admit that there has actually been a part of U.S. foreign policy that has promoted torture, that has promoted assassination of human rights advocates. And in terms of those earlier manuals, what's known as Operation Condor, in terms of Latin America and Vietnam, there was an operation known as Operation Phoenix. There are many times that both the CIA as well as other security agencies have promoted the actual use of torture in the history of the United States, and clearly that was used at the School of the Americas. It seems like it's a very important moment for us to remember our history so that we can look at what's happening in Abu Ghraib, we can look at what's happening at Guantanamo Bay, we can look at the training that's taking place at the School of the Americas, and we can start to act as a people of conscience to stop this kind of training from taking place.
I know that your work over at the School of the Americas Watch has included trying to get this information in the hands of the U.S. press corps when they were looking at the Iraqi prison abuse story. What kind of reaction did you have from the U.S. press?
The Detroit Free Press, which is a fairly conservative publication in Michigan, actually ran an editorial calling for the closure of the school in light of what's happening in Abu Ghraib, calling the school Torture U. The Chicago Tribune did a rather extensive piece on the School of the Americas and related the connections to what has happened and is happening in Iraq right now. And there have been several other newspapers that have ran stories, but it hasn't received the kind of attention that one would expect when it comes out very clearly that what's happening in Iraq is not an isolated incident, but it's actually a matter of U.S. foreign policy. Which has been interesting over the past few weeks is that we at the School of the Americas Watch, this organization to close the school that's located at Fort Benning, we've been receiving many calls every day from members of the international press, mainstream papers and networks from international publications and networks have been very willing to cover the story, but we haven't found that kind of enthusiasm in the United States so far.
That was Eric LeCompte, organizing coordinator with School of the Americas Watch. Call the group at area code 202-234-3440 or visit their website at www.soaw.org. With the continuing investigations into the abuse of Iraqi detainees at the U.S.-run Abu Ghraib prison, one disturbing element of the story that has surfaced is the alleged participation by private civilian contractors in the mistreatment of these prisoners. The Pentagon is spending billions of dollars to hire private companies to do the work once done by the military itself. From preparing meals for the troops to transporting fuel and supplies to the interrogation of prisoners, the government is outsourcing these duties to large corporations, some with very close ties to the White House. The privatization of government functions and the parallel downsizing of the federal workforce is not limited to the Pentagon, but in fact is widespread throughout dozens of government agencies. But as lucrative contracts are awarded to big companies like Halliburton, often without competitive bidding, oversight and monitoring of the work done has been eviscerated or placed in the hands of the contractors themselves. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Michael Scherer, Washington correspondent for Mother Jones magazine, who discusses his investigation into the government's flawed system of hiring private companies titled Contracts with America, published in the May-June issue of the magazine.
contract employees work in all levels of the military in Iraq. It's not just providing laundry and bathrooms and food for troops. It's not just actually maintaining and operating weapon systems. It's managing a lot of the operations of other contractors. It's doing interrogations. It's working with hand-in-hand with government employees in all manner of the reconstruction, all corners of the Coalition Provisional Authority under Paul Bremer. We have never before in the history of our country had a war that has been fought with such dependence on the private sector.
Could you give us the broad outline of the story you uncovered about contracting and the millions, if not billions, of dollars that have been overcharged to the U.S. government as a result of lax or non-existent oversight?
Well, the issue I looked at in my story was the degree to which the American government is losing control of its contracting workforce. We've outsourced so much that used to be done by government employees to the private sector, and so much of that work is now being overseen by other contractors. So not only outsource the work, we've outsourced the oversight of that work. And on top of that, during the 1990s, during the Clinton years and continued under the Bush presidency, the rules which govern how contractors win contracts, how much competition there needs to be, how many audits there needs to be, have really been relaxed. So we have now a situation in which companies like Halliburton, which have a number of very large contracts in Iraq, are legally buying the U.S. gasoline for the Iraqi people, $2.64 a gallon, whereas the federal buyers, the people for the Defense Energy Support Center, this is an agency that's job it is to buy gasoline for the American military, are paying about half that from Kuwait. So you have scandals like that, this bribery scandal that Halliburton's been accused of being involved in. Their largest contract, which is something called the logistical support contract, is structured in a way that the more money Halliburton spends, the more money they will make in profit. So there's not really much incentive to bid down costs, and there's absolutely no competition in the awarding of projects because we've essentially given one company, Halliburton in this case, a monopoly over supporting our troops in the field.
Michael, tell us what's going on with congressional investigations into the lack of oversight, price fixing, the no-bid contracts that you examine in your article, by the private contractors who are spending literally billions of U.S. taxpayer dollars?
Not much is being done in Congress. It's become a political football in an election year, and that means that Democrats want to mention Halliburton as much as they possibly can at every opportunity and sort of use the company as a way to demonize the administration because, of course, Vice President Dick Cheney was their former CEO. Republicans, for exactly the same reasons, don't want to mention Halliburton ever and therefore won't hold hearings on these issues. I mean, there have been a couple hearings that have been grudgingly held and structured in a way that you can't really question the right people on the right issues. At the same time, I think there is much more popular awareness of this issue. You know, 5-10 years ago, it would have been tough to get anyone anywhere to even care about how the government buys stuff. I mean, it's pretty boring stuff, and you know, something that gets accountants and auditors excited. I think today, companies like Halliburton and Bechtel are sort of household names, and private contractors are in the news all the time, and people are raising really legitimate questions across the board in the media, in think tanks, in Congress, about what is the right role for these companies? What do we want them doing? How do we want to be regulating them? One of the sort of side notes of this prison scandal in Iraq is that the contractors who have been accused of doing bad things there's no clear legal process for prosecuting them. It wasn't until March that the Pentagon even proposed rules for how to deal with contractors who are operating in a combat zone. So it's not clear that they fall under the military code of justice. It's not clear they can be tried in American courts for doing terrible things to Iraqis in Iraq. It's not clear that there's any Iraqi courts that have jurisdiction over them either. So, I mean, there are real complications like this that are just now coming out. So I think there is a popular upswell. Whether that translates into political movement, I don't think anything's going to happen before the election day just because there's just too much riding on these issues. Pat Leahy, a Democrat senator from Vermont, put language in one of the supplemental appropriations that said if any company is found, or any individual, American individual, is found profiteering from this war, they will face, you know, these penalties, and they were significant penalties. And I think it definitely passed the Senate. I think that language may have passed the House. And in conference committee, Republicans, who dominate Congress now, took that language out, and there was no real explanation as to why they took it out. It was just language saying, if you do something illegal, you will be punished in this way. So there clearly is a lobby that is at work, you know, from these companies who are not interested in being held accountable if they're caught doing stuff they shouldn't be doing.
Given the kind of deadlock in Congress and, little expectation that there'll be some serious investigations before the election, what, if anything, can individual citizens or groups of citizens do to tackle this issue, what seems to be an obscene gravy train at the same time as this very costly war is going on, both in terms of blood and cash?
Well, we actually have a really well-functioning democratic system here, and even though there is gridlock in Congress, members of Congress, both in the House and the Senate, really do care when their constituents get upset about something, and they do act, and it does matter. And I think it's something that a lot of people who are outside of Washington become cynical about and don't realize. They think, if I just write another letter, it's not going to matter. I think it does, and I think if people are upset about these issues, the thing to do is to make clear, to pollsters, to newspaper editorial pages, to their congresspeople when they come to visit or if they write letters or emails, that these are issues that they care about, and it will filter up, especially in election year when a lot of people are going to be looking everywhere they can to find votes.
That was Michael Scherer, Washington correspondent for Mother Jones Magazine. Read his article, Contracts with America, online at www.motherjones.com. In mid-May, President Bush's Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz went to Congress with a vaguely worded request for an additional $25 billion as a down payment for upcoming military expenditures in Iraq. This time, congressional leaders told him to come back when he was ready to present a more specific outline of funding needs. But these catch-all funding requests have become commonplace under the Bush administration, both in its regular budgets and in supplemental budget requests for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. The sluggish economy of recent years, combined with enormous tax cuts primarily benefiting the wealthiest sector and growing military expenditures, have pushed this year's projected deficit to $400 billion. The Bush tax cuts alone will drain over $3 trillion in revenue losses over the next 10 years. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Max Zawicki, senior economist with the Economic Policy Institute, who talks about the burgeoning military budget and ballooning federal deficit, which depleted the budget surplus of the late 1990s with potentially damaging consequences for the U.S. economy.
In 2000, the outlays were less than $300 billion for defense. That's not all in the Defense Department, but it includes some things like atomic energy and other things. Now it's, for fiscal year 04, the year we're in, it's now over $450 billion. That's a 50% increase.
Does that include the money for Homeland Security?
No, that's a separate department.
So with enormous increases in military spending and enormous tax cuts, there's got to be a squeeze somewhere.
If Congress observed a budget constraint, there would be a squeeze. Now, since the surpluses of the late 90s, the Congress has not observed any budget restraint, even after the huge deficits began to appear after Bush came into office. And even as we speak, they're passing more tax cuts. They talk about spending restraint every year. They haven't exercised any. There's been pretty broadly distributed increases on the domestic side, not only on the defense side. Now, there's been some areas that have been less well nourished than others. But right now, and for the past 5-8 years, basically since 1997, the Congress really hasn't exercised any budget discipline in the sense that they've not announced they're going to have a certain target for deficits and stick to it with the decisions they make on taxes and spending.
There are so many cuts to state and municipal budgets, resulting in things like bigger class sizes, reducing library hours, having to pay a premium for all kinds of services that used to be covered just by the taxes people pay.
The state and local sector suffered a lot in the recession, and the federal government did very little to help them, and that gave rise to the cuts that you're talking about. There were also, there were all kinds of cuts at the state level. The states don't have the borrowing power the federal government does, so they're not able to sail through these periods the way the feds could. There's a question of comparing what is needed to what's provided. What's provided is arguably insufficient from the standpoint of what's needed. When you have a recession, any such need becomes worse, more pressing. So through the recession, the federal government was very inadequate in terms of providing the kind of aid that would have been useful in alleviating the suffering that you're alluding to. So in terms of providing less than before, well, yeah, in the sense that when you have a recession, the needs are greater. So you're, when you provide the same in a period when the need has increased, then in a sense you're doing less. In 2001, the projected deficits for the next 10 years were actually a surplus of over $5.6 trillion. And in the course of 3 or 4 years, that turned around to projected deficits of $3 trillion or so. So you had a huge turnaround in the fiscal position of the federal government, and part of that financed that spending growth, and part of it financed the tax cuts that we saw.
So what's the impact of increased military spending on the domestic side?
What has not been the case so far, although we're starting to see signs of it, is that the growth on the military side has had some, has pinched very much on the domestic side. So far, that hasn't happened.
So with these massive tax cuts and increases in military spending, why isn't the domestic side being pinched more?
Because they end up borrowing a ton of money. The problem with deficits is not this year's amount or last year's. The problem is that looking down the line over the next 10 years, they're projected to grow more rapidly than the economy grows. Meaning, when I say grow, I mean that I'm talking about the debt. The accumulation of debt, public debt, over the next 10 years goes up faster than the GDP. And you want some debt is okay, some growth in it is okay, but if it grows more rapidly than the economy grows, that means that your ability to pay the interest on that debt diminishes, and that makes financial markets nervous. It leads to spikes in interest rates and problems in the economy. I have a feeling that Congress is not really going to be forced to do anything difficult as far as fiscal discipline goes until there's some eruption in financial markets that forces them to act.
That was Max Zewicki of the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, D.C. For more information on the deficit and its impact, call the Institute at area code 202-775-8810 or visit their website at www.epinet.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.